Somebody's leaving already. That was a bit dry. Right. Colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, friends, as Marys said, I'm Stuart Lang, Deputy Vice-Chancellor of the University of Brighton, and I'd like to welcome you to this evening's event, which actually has a dual function. It's both an inaugural university professorial lecture for a new visiting professor, and it's very much part of the event that I know has been going on today and will tomorrow. So two for the price of one, I think. And Arthur Dahl is our speaker on both counts. Arthur Dahl is now a visiting professor in this university's Faculty of Science and Engineering. As an undergraduate, Arthur studied biological sciences at Stanford in the early 1960s and went on to get a doctorate in biology from the University of California, Santa Barbara. He then moved on, working for 5 years as a researcher at the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, D.C., with fieldwork in the Caribbean and the Pacific on coral reef ecology, marine algae, and island environments. In 1974, he became a regional ecological advisor for the South Pacific Commission and then moved to be a consultant to many governments, the United Nations Environment Programme, UNEP, and the World Conservation Union, before becoming deputy to the director of the Oceans and Coastal Area Programmes Activity Centre in the UNEP in the late 1980s. Arthur eventually became affiliated with the Geneva UNEP office, responsible for coordinating the UN system-wide Earthwatch. In 2000, Arthur became director of the Coral Reef Unit of UNEP, responsible for providing global leadership and building international partnerships for the assessment, protection, and sustainable management of coral reefs and related ecosystems. Since retiring from the UN about 8 years ago now, Arthur's continued to carry out consultancies from them, especially on national environmental assessment and reporting. He's worked with the World Economic Forum on the Global Competitiveness Report of 2004, in 2005, the Environmental Sustainability Index, and also the Environmental Performance Index of 2006. At the same time, Arthur has also been heavily involved in the University of Geneva's Environmental Diplomacy Programme, which attracts participants from government departments around the globe, and the Committee on the Problems of the Environment, a project assessing indicators of sustainable development. It was, in fact, this area of work, Arthur's work on indicators, which brought him into contact with this university. Round about 4 years ago, he began to speak with Professor Mary Harder about the rather, what seemed at the time, to some at least, a rather unlikely possibility of indicators being developed for something which most people perhaps assumed was not measurable, values. After discussions with several civil society organisations and experts in indicators at the University of Charles in Prague, Mary and Arthur developed a new consortium project to try to develop values-based indicators. And the conference being held this week, today, tomorrow, is a testimony to the success of that project, which seems to have applications, we feel, in many fields, from sustainable development to general project evaluation, from business to international development. This university is really honoured that a man with such a distinguished career and such a profound sense of values as Arthur Dahl has agreed to join the ranks of our professoriate. And also it's great that he's here as a central guide to our conference. And I think we're all looking forward to what he has to say this evening under his title of Life, a Systems Approach, Reflections on Multiple Dimensions of Sustainability. Ladies and gentlemen, Professor Arthur Dahl.
Thank you very much. I find it a bit of a challenge to be giving an inaugural lecture 8 years after retirement. What is there still to inaugurate? You know, at the almost the end of one's career, one should be doing this sometime earlier, perhaps. But it has been an opportunity to try to think, is there any logic? Is there anything? When I look back at a career of more than 40 years, what does it mean? What is implied by it? And I've therefore been sort of forced to say, what coherence might there be to what's been a very weaving process in and out of academia, science, governments, and so on and so forth? So the talk this evening is an attempt to try and pull this all together and to draw some lessons from it for the issues of sustainability, the issues of the future of our society. And so I hope that will be of interest. It's a very varied kind of talk. I try to put something in it for everybody, from art lovers to so on and so forth. So if you get bored of one part of it, maybe some other part of the talk will be of some interest to you. Of course, being a scientist, we know that science is the great knowledge system on which modern civilization has been built. And yet, in spite of all that science has done for civilization, something is clearly missing. If we look at climate change, we look like we're going to be cooking the planet by the end of the century, where the predictions seem to be getting worse all of the time. We look at soil degradation, one of the sort of unsung problems. Well, I think The Guardian has just come up with an article this week pointing out this is where we've been missing this. But 35% of all the arable land of the planet has been degraded since World War II, an area equal to China and India combined. Now, most past civilizations have collapsed when they ran out of food, destroyed their agricultural base, so it's rather worrying what we're now doing at a planetary level. Working with coral reefs, of course, I'm concerned about the impact, and they're probably the first major ecosystem to be collapsing at a global scale. There's at the moment a bleaching event across the Indian Ocean, why 80% of the corals in that part of the world, so the problems are clearly continuing. And we think our civilization, it runs on fossil fuels. These are the estimates of peak oil, ranging from the extreme greens on the far left side through the oil companies in the middle, so you don't think Shell, Total should be getting things totally wrong, to the extreme optimists. And you can see that even the most optimistic ones say we run, you know, peak oil at the very latest is 2050. More likely 2030 as at the optimistic range of things. So any civilization that it runs on a fossil fuel subsidy can't last very long. And of course, all of this is expected to lead to hundreds of millions of climate refugees. We're going to be seeing a mixing of the planetary population at a scale we've never seen before. If you think we have problems with immigrants now, imagine what it'll be like when there are hundreds of millions of people who are forced to move because the sea level has risen and their homes have been drowned, or there's no water left to drink, or no soil to. So there are major. These problems are coming faster than most people realize, because the whole process is accelerating. And as I think Sir John Bennington said a year and a half ago, the UK chief scientist, the world faces a perfect storm of problems in 2030 as food, energy, and water shortages interact with climate change to produce public unrest, cross-border conflicts, and mass migrations. So science doesn't seem to have solved all of our problems. It may even have created many of them. And this, of course, is nothing new. The great Limits to Growth Report of the Club of Rome in 1972, for which I did a book review at the time, predicted everything would be fine until about 2015, 2020, 2030, when we could expect the collapse of civilization. In the update they did for the Rio Earth Summit, which these graphics came from, they said, if we changed after Rio towards a transition, we could avoid the worst and could stabilize the world. If we waited until 2015, we couldn't help avoiding a serious problem mid-century before achieving sustainability at a much lower level of standard of living than we could have had we made the change sooner. And nobody has yet done any studies that shows that these general predictions are very far off what seems to be the case. The latest study suggests that there's nothing that says they've been wrong yet. So how can we reconcile humanity and the environment? And this is, in a sense, been my lifelong question and challenge, working on the different elements of the issue. Is there some way, on what basis, can we try to bring human society together with the needs, the requirements of the environment? And I'll be looking at it at a whole different levels of systems organization, starting, of course, with my own specialization, the living systems that we study in biology, extending then to ecosystems of life in a whole larger environment, looking at human environment systems as a more integrated unit, looking at the information dimension of systems, which is one of my particular interests, a better look at economic systems, systems of governance and management, you might say scaling up gradually the social and spiritual dimensions of human systems and the planetary system itself, because we're dealing with issues that require a more integrated approach at all of these levels. And of course, as already been said, I think some of the presentations today, sustainability is a systems concept, and in many ways, an ethical one as well. It's not a goal to be reached. We can't say tomorrow we are sustainable. That's like an airplane saying, we're going to stop right now, we're sustainable. You know, if the airplane stops, it's going to crash. You know, we're a dynamic system, and it's maintaining a balance in space and in time. That is what sustainability is all about. And to do that, we have complex interactions in the whole system that maintain the Earth, the biological system, which already has its own requirements for sustainability, but then now adding the social and economic components and respecting planetary limits. And today, man has finally scaled up to that global level of something called the Anthropocene, where the major impact on all planetary systems is humanity and other behavior. We have to learn how to manage that, and that means managing people, which is the thing that we seem to be the hardest at doing. If looking over my career, I said, are there some basic research questions that have come up again and again around which much of my work has centered? And these are the ones that I sort of pulled out as saying, this is probably what, in the various parts of my career, I've looked at as being critically important. What do all systems have in common? How do the parts make a more dynamic whole? How does evolutionary progress come with dynamic equilibrium, this constant movement and change, but it's always still in balance? And how is that balance being maintained? What are the system control mechanisms and information flows that make that system possible, that allow the parts to communicate in a sense and keep the balance that is necessary? And how do we maintain or restore that balance, since today we're upsetting almost every natural balance on the planet? And then ultimately, what unites rather than divides? Because systems are unified systems, they come together. So what is it that makes things come together into a system as opposed to something that fragments and disintegrates and falls apart? Because that's fundamentally the kinds of challenges we face in our society today. I'll also be touching in one way or another on a number of other issues, particularly some of concern in the academic community, of specialization versus generalization, of the analysis of the parts versus integration of the whole, our disciplines we enjoy and are comfortable disciplines with, opposed to inter or multi or transdisciplinarity, basic versus applied science, how much do we say in the pure side and how much do we get involved in the problems of the world, the ivory tower versus action in the real world. I guess I've done some of both. I actually had an office in an ivory-colored tower of an old castle with a view of Mont Blanc, so I had my experience of ivory towerness in a very practical and meaningful way. The scientific elite or science for everyone. We tend to say scientists are only those who've earned a PhD in a major university and so on. Is this really what we need for science in the 21st century? And then areas that are sort of off limits to science, like religion. And also those other more intangible sides of looking at nature that might be feelings that nature can inspire, its beauty, the awe that you feel, the wonder, the humility we feel before the powers of the natural world, our sense of connection with it, things that are powerfully important for many people, but again, escape from a typical scientific perspective. Probably this all started because I was raised on the coast of California, which isn't the ugliest place to be born, and so it was natural from an early age to be curious about marine biology, and inevitably that's where I was led by the environment that was around me. I had a childhood mentor by the name of Vincent Brown, who was a naturalist, a biologist, and Baha'i, who gave me a book called How to Make a Home Nature Museum when I was about 10 years old, and so I was stuffing gophers and doing all sorts of things like that. And he was teaching us in our Baha'i classes about the natural world. He also wrote a book called Warriors of the Rainbow, because he was very interested in the Indian peoples, the Native Americans. And this book became the foundation of the philosophy of Greenpeace, which is why they always have a boat called the Rainbow Warrior. So with an interesting cross currents across different elements of the environmental movement. So looking a bit at the biological side of my career and what it may have brought to this more systematic perspective, obviously in biology we look at living systems, and they already have multiple levels of complexity, from the molecule to the gene, the cell, the organ, organism, species, and ecosystems. As we already mentioned, I studied at Stanford University. I studied evolution with Paul Ehrlich, back when he was just a specialist on butterflies, before he was known for his environmental work later on. My senior honors on plumbless mediation in plants was with Peter Raven. I published my first summary as an undergraduate on food preferences in periwinkles. So I had a reasonable start already in science at that university, where they encouraged a lot of exploration among students. I then went on to do my PhD in marine biology and ecology at Santa Barbara. Of course, there we looked at the systems in a broader sense, their diversity, stability, and efficiency, the dynamic equilibria that are maintained in systems, things like competition, collaboration, symbioses, the vulnerability and resistance of systems. All these overall systems qualities were part of what we learned as biologists. And of course, we saw them within the science of biology and didn't necessarily say, what does this mean beyond that science? Because those weren't the questions we were asking so much at the time. In fact, my doctoral work, I found this rather interesting seaweed on the beach with two very different forms in different environments. What is it that makes the plant so different depending on where it's growing? And so I started looking at the cells and saying, what does each cell need to know in order to communicate with other cells to know its role as part of the plant to generate the shell of the plant? And I worked out a simple program. It actually needed to know how long it was and how wide it was and whether it was at the end of the plant. And with that, it could do its function as a cell and the plant would generate itself. I then went down to also look at how was the cell constructed within the cell and how does this relate to the way in which the cell maintains the form of the plant. Then did experiments growing the plant in various environmental conditions, say, how do cell division patterns vary and generate the forms of the plant in different conditions? So I actually integrated everything from ultrastructure to the ecology to try to get a systems view of that particular plant and those things that made it the plant that it was in its particular environment. And from that, I learned very early that complexity can develop from very simple rules and interactions. It didn't take a lot, I mean, just a few, and all of this would generate. Of course, we've since learned about fractals and so on, and this has developed. But it was a very early lesson that I had in biology that helped me take a systems view of all those things that came later. And of course, biology gives us the elements like a way of thinking about systems, the fact that they, as I mentioned, are dynamic, that the processes are as important as the states or structures, that we look very much at causes and effects within the system, the interactions and integration are elements, and that often systems have emergent properties, qualities of the whole system that you cannot predict from each of the components. So these are sort of basic lessons of systems thinking that came out of my work in science that I found have been helpful throughout my career. Of course, the early 1960s was also a time of the beginning of the environmental movement. And so I was inevitably caught up in the environmental challenge. I was actually doing bird counts for the Audubon Society when I was an early teenager. I went to a marine parks conference in Tokyo in 1966, getting more involved in nature conservation. Santa Barbara oil spill, well, it came with my research material, so I had to do pollution studies by default. And then I did a report in the Office of American Samoa for the government there. Spoke at the first Earth Day in Washington in 1970. Gave a whole set of lectures to all the high schools in Belize while doing research there, again, in the early 70s. Represented the Baha'i international community at the Stockholm Conference in 1972. So you might say the early environmental movement had sort of sucked me in from the beginning, and I caught the first wave, you know, of that process. And of course, the Santa Barbara oil spill, it was very much like the recent spill in the Gulf, an offshore oil well that blew out, that they couldn't control for a couple of months. And so the beautiful white cliffs of Santa Barbara, like the white cliffs of Dover, turned out to be tarred and feathered between the dead birds and so on. It's a pretty good description. And it went on. And as I say, my research material was right there along the beach, so I had to do pollution studies. The first studies of the impact of the oil spill were sort of thrust upon me by the environmental problems at the time. I also had my first opportunities of being visiting developing countries. And ever since I was 10, I'd wanted to work on developing country issues. I thought, that's really where the needs are that raise the poor countries. And so I developed this idea. I really wanted to become an environmental advisor to developing countries, to governments. This seemed to be a new kind of career that was needed, but didn't exist in the early 60s. And so how do you prepare yourself for a career that doesn't yet exist? How do you create a career? And it was part of the challenges as I went along. So going to the Smithsonian Institution, I was associate curator of algae in the Department of Botany, but focused very much on coral reef ecology. My professor was a specialist on the Antarctic. And I think, well, corals only grow in waters over 20 degrees. So as a working environment, I'd rather do that than chopping holes in the ice. And so, and of course, the fascination of the complex systems also attracted me. So I was an aquanaut in the Puerto Rico International Undersea Laboratory, living for 2 weeks at the bottom of the sea, the bottom of a coral reef. And as I mentioned, starting long-term monitoring of the reefs of American Samoa. We had a baseline going back to 1917, so we actually could look at decadal variations in the evolution of the reefs and the changes and the impacts of the environment over long periods of time. Of course, algae were still one of my major interests, but I went far beyond that to look at the system of the reef as a whole. And when you look at a reef, it has a very complex spatial organization because it's, of course, it's one of the only ecosystems that creates its own environment. The reef is entirely built by biological activity. It's all skeletons of animals and plants. And so it's very similar to another built environment. Even physically, they look the same. And in fact, you look at individual corals, and all the little polyps look so much like the apartment buildings we build, except that nobody hangs out their balcony to catch birds going by the way the corals are out there trying to catch plankton. But you know, there's a certain functional similarity between the built environments in nature and in man that emphasizes to me at an early stage there must be something we can learn from the biological systems about how we should be designing human systems. And of course, these are fantastically complex systems. I mean, recently there was some studies done. The corals were more efficient at capturing light than land plants. And somebody said, why is this? They realized that each coral in its skeleton creates a kind of a reflector in the calcium carbonate skeleton that focuses any light that's missed by the plants the first time through is reflected back again, and means photosynthesis is much more efficient in corals than it is even in plants, because you have animals with plants living inside of them. You can't get much greater integration than that. It's not cows grazing on the grass. You sit there in the sun and you make their food. It's really, you know, a very efficient kind of system. Of course, there are many other kinds of collaboration, cooperation, symbioses in coral reefs. Nemo has become famous about the symbiosis between clownfish and anemones. And so I tried to develop indicators of how did the system work. And surface area, of course, was an important functional characteristic. So I tried to estimate surface area indices for various kinds of coral reefs. We tried to develop a model. There were three or four young, bright, crazy young biologists at Smithsonian. Let's do a computer model of a coral ecosystem. So we got a grant from the NSF. We got 80 of the world's lead scientists together to put together the plan for the reef. We developed plans like this for all of 104 compartments of the reef system that we defined, produced a lovely matrix of all of their interactions, went back to NSF, and they said, sorry, we can't afford pay you $10 million a year for 10 years to pay for biology. We've got to pay for the oceanographic vessels. So we published the model in its theoretical form, but the computers weren't ready for it at the time anyway. 1972 was not really the time to be modeling things to the scale. But the plans are there. I've got them all in my files. Anybody wants to take it on and run with it now, I'll be happy to pass it on to the next generation. But we learned a lot from working on coral reefs. You know, they're very efficient at solar energy capture and materials capture. Because the reef environment, the water is so transparent because it's a desert. There's nothing in the seawater. It's all been stripped out. And you have the very complex system living in a resource-poor environment. And it does it because it recycles materials within the system. It transfers energy very efficiently within the system. There's very little waste. You've got high levels of integration among all the components of the system because, of course, it's evolved for a long period. You can find fossil reefs 20 million years old with some of the same species as you see on reefs today. So they've had a time to evolve these very high levels of interaction and complexity. They're very dynamic within certain limits. They're being smashed by cyclones and so on and so forth, and they quickly regenerate again. But they can't necessarily tolerate the kinds of things we're doing to them now, like acidification of the oceans, raising temperature beyond their lethal limits with global warming, overfishing and removing whole components of the system. So they have a resilience, but we're pushing it beyond its limit, and they're now collapsing around the world. When I show my coral reef slides to people today, they say, it's not like that anymore. You know, we've lost 80% of the corals in the Caribbean. We're seeing die-offs, you know, in the Indian Ocean, so on and so forth. It's really a tragedy, the rate at which we're losing some of these important biological that should be models for us for the future. And also for those economists here, the reef doesn't, it maximizes the total productivity of the whole system. It's not just the one most productive factory that puts everybody else out of business. But you have very productive plants and animals, and then underneath them you've got something catching everything that was left by them, the next bit of light, and then another layer catching something more, and then boring algae down in the corals, the last little bits of light. And so even though they're very inefficient, they're still adding something to the total system. We've lost that concept in our economy today. We're not finding some way that every human being can contribute some additional wealth, even if it's only limited more. So there are a whole series of conceptual principles from the biological system that can serve as models that we should be looking at more widely. Also, later in my career, as mentioned, I went back to organize a coral reef unit to try to save the coral reefs of the world and develop the International Coral Reef Action Network. So I've worked on this problem from several different perspectives. But then going on, you might say, to the human dimensions of a systems approach, which is one that gets closer to the interests of this conference. our materialistic world has sort of ignored the human side of sustainability. We look at more on the scientific side than really what it means in human terms. In fact, we become polarized between economic liberalism and social welfare, political right and left, as if we had to choose one or the other, when each of them has some element of what we need. We should be trying to bring these things all together as complementary aspects of a whole system that is human development, and we're still far from achieving that level of integration. So logically for me to say, well, you better start with something simple if you're going to look at a human environment system. So take something like an island. Can you get much simpler than that as a human environment system? Where do you throw your garbage? That was my laboratory we set up on the Belize Barrier Reef at Smithsonian Institution. So I've lived there. But that's where you really get a sense of limits and trying to live within your limits. And then, of course, going on, when I had the opportunity, I was offered the position. Ecologists were 22 countries in the South Pacific in 1974. I went to New Caledonia, and among other things, we negotiated a convention on conservation of nature in the South Pacific. I was asked to do a regional... This was the days that said, please study all the extents of our region. It's just one quarter of the Earth's surface. The government said, give us a word next year. What do we have to save? So you had to be a kind of a generalist in that sense, in working in that sort of situation. I also organized and established the South Pacific Regional Environment, which is now an intergovernmental program working across the region for all of its environmental issues. And of course, when you look at these islands, they really are microcosms of human... That is three quarters of the Republic of Nauru. How many of you have heard of the Republic of Nauru? A few, that's good, reasonably good. At the time it had a population of 8,000 people with its own Air Nauru shipping company and so on, because the annual per capita income was over $100,000. It was up at the level of our, because they were mining phosphate. They were already destroyed two-thirds of their island, and they had a wonderful economy until about the year 2000 when the phosphate ran out. Not really a sustainable way of looking at the future of society, but an illustration, nevertheless, of the challenges that we face today. Islands are also nice because you can get everything from the mountains to the sea within a reachable distance. You don't have to go hundreds of kilometers to see the spectrum of different kinds of ecosystems. So they're very good models to study interests of environment and in humans coming together. In that post, I did various kinds of things, from doing a report on the state of the environment in the South Pacific for the Conference on the Human Environment. I mentioned the Ecosystem Survey. Did a survey of traditional environmental knowledge, because it seemed important there to root anything we were saying as scientists into the traditional culture and to show them that, in fact, your traditional values were very scientific. You had the master fisherman who knew everything about catching the fish, the master of the yams who had his little magical garden was saying, now is the time to plant, now watch this problem. So it was exactly like science today in a different intellectual framework. And so by validating their own traditional knowledge, you could build a foundation for taking on the new environmental concerns. I did such a thing, I said, we need to make science available to everybody. So I took 10 leading coral reef scientists, locked them on a little island off the coast of Papua New Guinea for a week, and said, I want a simple method to monitor coral reefs that anybody can do. And they say, we don't know how to do that, but they had nothing else to do for a week. So they sat down and got to work and said, we don't need Latin names for things, we don't need this, get rid of all the inessentials. And they came up with a 20-page coral reef monitoring handbook that anybody could do quantitative surveys of the changes in their reefs, their impact on their reefs. It was printed in a waterproof version so they could take it out on their boats with them and so on. And that graphic is still being used in most monitoring handbooks today because nobody will go into the trouble of saying, how do you estimate area coverage in different kinds of environments? And I've also developed a training program for rural areas and small island environmental management, and try to look at islands as a whole dynamic system. It was logical from a systems approach, where the remote sensing was possible. For instance, Aitutaki in the Cook Islands was hit by a terrible cyclone. We were able to get before and after spot images and quantify the total impact of the cyclone on the various ecosystems across and around the island. I also then sort of stood back from that and said, what about all islands? And so I was asked by IUCN to review protected areas in Oceania. Then I went on to do a directory of islands of the world, over 2,000 islands with all geographic, biological, human characteristics and so on, and created a database that allowed us to sort of say, what are the islands that are most at risk in terms of conservation interest? We're now updating this with a new database of over 100,000 islands, now that we have new kinds of data sets, we're able to go much further, to actually say, what can we do to help islands address their problems? And of course now it's as much as anything disappearing islands as they go underwater with climate change. But there are also systems lessons to learn from islands. Human environment interactions are just as complicated on a small scale. The fact that there are only a few of you doesn't mean that the problems are any easier. This seems to be a scale invariant kind of thing. Human problems, you know, they're there at all scales, from the micro to the macro. And the real problems we face generally are human rather than scientific. It's also clear, especially in these small-scale systems, that a whole systems approach, integrating the natural systems and the human communities with their cultures, institutions, and values, as well as the economies and social systems, necessary. We couldn't deal with bits and pieces. It had to be a system as a whole that was looked at. And so we designed our program to take an integrated look at the system, environment, and the human system together. But also, solutions had to be appropriate to each local environment, and which is very different from the model proposed by Western economic systems, selling the same McDonald's, you know, Big Mac to everybody around the world as the standard food item. I got into a truck in one island. They said, be careful, your foot will go through the floor. You know, it was all rusted out. I looked at the speedometer. It had gone something like 1,000 miles. And I said, how old is it? Oh, 18 months old. And it had rusted out at 18 months. Now here you were, we're importing vehicles that can go, you know, 200 kilometers an hour and have a range of 500 kilometers on an island that is 20 kilometers long and 5 kilometers wide and top speed of 20 kilometers an hour. Now, something is wrong. There's a mismatch of engineering there. We need to adapt the different solutions to the nature of the systems. You shouldn't be trying to do everything everywhere. And we've missed that in much of the globalization process today, which is aimed at uniform solutions to problems. Looking then at systems at the global level. Of course, going on from the region to the United Nations, inevitably I was looking at global scale problems, first with the ocean coastal areas, then coordinating the system-wide Earthwatch. So my job was to keep in touch with 50 different parts of the United Nations and get them to do something together. You can imagine it's like herding cats. Nobody wants to be coordinated. But we were able to set up global observing systems and various kinds of things. And for instance, looking at the whole planetary system, this was really interesting to take a totally global perspective. How do you assess the global environment and all its complexity? And I was analyzing all the scientific advisory processes to see what worked and what didn't work. How do you get science into these processes and make a difference in government decision making? We set up an integrated global observing strategy between all the world's space agencies, the research programs, UN agencies, to actually say who throws up which satellite to look at which thing at which time, instead of the Americans, the Chinese are all doing the same thing at the same time. It's very embarrassing. And therefore, everybody saw the need to collaborate, and we were able to get some kind of coherence in working on information for decision making at the global level. And of course, this then led me on to look at systems of governance, which are even more complex and weaker in many ways. So as I mentioned, I got started at the Stockholm Conference in 1972. And that was interesting when, you know, there was voting about wheelchair ramps for invalids in city planning. Now, what one government would vote against invalids in city planning? United States of America. Shirley Temple Black was instructed not to vote for anything that might increase foreign aid expenditures. And she was afraid they might have to pay for the wheelchairs if they voted for them. So I began to understand the lack of logic sometimes in international diplomacy. In, of course, the small islands, again, much of it was diplomatic work with the Commission organizing this big regional conference on the environment in 1982 and the Regional Environmental Program. I then did the islands part of Agenda 21, worked with the whole process of small and developing stints, the Mauritius International Meeting. So it's been one of the themes of my career, what can I do to make, to help islands, you know, sell the problems of islands around the world, because they're often been, you know, nobody paid attention. Islands, well, how many people do you have? You know, the Chinese say, how many people do you have in your country? 12,000, you know. You don't carry any weight. But when we got them together, and there were 43 votes in the General Assembly, suddenly there was an island country as a vice chair of every important committee. So there was, you know, there was a possibility to get some movement by getting to see the power of numbers, even if individually they didn't count for very much. As mentioned, I was in the Secretariat for the Rio Earth Summit, responsible for drafting the Oceans, Coastal Areas and Islands chapter, and then following up the work for about 10 years afterwards, the Commission on Sustainable Development. I was again back at the summit in Johannesburg, launching the Core Earth Action Network as a Type 2 partnership, and also organizing environment forum, parallel events and sustainable indicators, education, local science, business. Bernard Modin spoke to our session in Johannesburg as well in the part of the science forum. And then, of course, most recently, most depressingly, going to the Copenhagen conference last December. I said I was going to skip Cancun. Didn't want to be depressed twice in a row. But speaking mostly on climate ethics issues. But that's where we really could see that the multilateral system, as it's designed now, just isn't up to the problems that we're facing. And I've just been named to a major groups and stakeholders advisor group, International Environmental Governance, making recommendations to the ministers, to the UN Governing Council, and to the Rio Plus 20 process on questions like, how do we build institutions for governance at the scale of the problem? How do we ensure that planetary resources are managed sustainably and equitably? How do we overcome the limitations of national sovereignty in a globalized world? How to prepare for the coming migrations? There's some key issues that we need to push onto the agenda, and civil society has to do it because governments aren't doing it. If you might say, what are the lessons learned from assistance perspective at the global level? I think it's clear threats to the planetary environment can only be addressed globally. You need other levels as well, but there's some things we can only deal with globally, and we're far from having institutions capable of doing that. I mean, people want to do geoengineering. Well, let's tinker with the environment, try something out. Who's going to approve it? Who's going to do the scientific assessments? Who's going to say, no, that's too dangerous? It's a total vacuum. And we're extremely vulnerable to any entrepreneur who thinks they can make a killing and there's nothing we can do about it. Or any government that thinks they can get an advantage for themselves. The Russians at one point were going to launch some giant reflectors to shine sunlight on the northern cities along Siberia in the wintertime to remove the winter depression without thinking about the impact of creating new suns up there lighting the whole planet any other time. Fortunately, they did actually launch one, and it failed to open. So we had a technical failure that was very fortunate for the survival of model life on the planet. But we also have to recognize there's very little science in environmental diplomacy. Science really is very down the scale when they look at who's going to decide what. It's mostly national interest, political expediency, negotiating tactics. We'll give you this if you give us that in this other negotiating process, and so on. Or simply the fear of creating precedents. If we admit we have historic responsibility for climate change, they'll ask us to pay for all of it. And therefore, they don't want to take even a first step in that direction. And of course, the environment is usually not a priority when the economy is at stake. And we've seen that the money that went into the banks, that money that's going into other things today, the priorities as they're defined in the present system are not helping us move towards sustainability. There's little concern for the common interest. And so therefore, I think system based on national sovereignty is just, it's now broken. We've got to say, what can we do to try to fix it? Or what do we plan to put in its place when it finally breaks completely and collapses and we're forced to go take the next step beyond it? So there's clearly government's challenges ahead. Let's see what we can do at the Rio Plus 20 conference in 2012, because governance is one of the main agenda items. But will this be enough for the great transition? The limits to growth are coming closer and closer. The time is really very limited. As I mentioned briefly, perhaps one of my interests has been information in systems, or information controlling systems, or flowing in systems. And of course, this is logical, because you might say, at the chemical level, the information is coded in atoms. They have so many electrons, it allows them to combine in different ways, and therefore molecules form or don't form because information in the atoms. In biology, it's DNA that codes the information. For an engineer, it's the engineer's imagination or the plans that he writes out for the machine that's going to be built. For institutional system, it's the statutes, the laws, the regulations, the practices and customs that are sort of the foundation for the institution's work. And human social systems really are values, our beliefs, our cultures. It's at that level that we need to be pushing for change if we want to really get change in human systems. Transmission of information is another critical systems dimension, whether it be how information is communicated in and through and around the systems. And it's everything in biology. Sometimes there's chemicals that seep into the water. There's chemical, electrical signaling, many different kinds of ways of information is flowed. We probably only know half of them or less than half of them because we just haven't measured many of these things. It's interesting also that efficient systems are very economical. It's not like our emails today, where you simply can't keep up with the flow of information. They've learned that only what the information you need, not too much, don't overload the system. And therefore, controlling the flow of information and where it goes is extremely important. There's often feedback loops so that information comes back again to tell you to stop doing this or to start doing that. We often see nested subsystems. So a lot of things are organized at a small scale. Most information conveyed within the system, and only a few things communicate next level. So cells communicate only a few things to other cells in the tissue or other organs and so on. The way in which systems are designed is through the information that was critically important to the all functioning, the overall system. You see a lot of subsidiarity, decision-making at the lowest possible level, closest to where the problem is, the use of indicators, what it can use to signal important parts of the system with a limited amount of information. Looking at the information dimension is sort of opens your eyes to what's really important about systems and how you analyze, how you understand what makes them work, why they are successful. And I actually, in my mid-career synthesis was a book I wrote just after Rio, The Eco-Principle, Ecology, Economics, and Symbiosis, where I tried to integrate science, economics, values in one sort of overview of where we were going. And then also organizing the International Environment Forum, trying to bring professionals to bring values, ethical approaches into sustainability. Now, I've had a few dabbles in economics. I'm not an economist. I did take Economics 1 at university, but some economists have had confidence in me and have asked me to do some things. So, for instance, the World Economic Forum asked me to how do we bring environment into their work in a more modern way than the end-of-pipe solutions of the 1970s? So they allowed me to put 20 questions in the Executive Opinion Survey, and we got nearly 9,000 responses from the 30,000 business leaders who were being sampled, so reasonably good return rate. And then, just in concluding, what we saw was there was a very close correlation between global competitiveness on the vertical axis and my environmental responsibility and social liking on the horizontal. Very close correlation between the two. The most efficient economies were the most environmentally responsible. So there's no competition between environment and business. On the contrary, business said, we need strong government regulation fairly enforced. Then we can show our innovation and our ability to respond to the requirements of society. If there are no regulations that you could pay under the table to avoid them, we're all brought down to the lowest common denominator, and it's bad for everybody. But we've got to get this message across to governments, because they still think the environment is bad for business in many cases. They also asked me to look at Taiwan as a case study. How did a poor tropical island 50 years become one of the world's leading economies at the cutting edge of environmental technology? It was fascinating to go and talk with the business leaders, with the government officials, and so on and so forth, and to see that really there was a very close collaboration between government and the private sector. Long term, so you think, where do you want to be in 20, 30, 40, 50 years? And planning each step ahead, enormous investments in education and creating human capital, in reversing the brain drain and bringing back the brightest brains to build the institution, so on. A whole sort of thing, and it was all about collaboration, cooperation, moving together, very much, very different from the idea of competition and struggling to get ahead. And in fact, 97% of the businesses were small and medium enterprises, very few big companies. But these small companies would change product lines every 6 months, very adaptable, able to keep up with the rapid evolution of the technology, very fascinating example to look at. And then I've been involved as well in the European Bi-Business Forum, one of the partners in the Indicators project here, trying to bring values into business. Of course, this then leads us to indicators, which is again one of my major interests. You saw I was doing indicators of coral reefs back in the early 1970s, indicators of islands in the 1980s. So it's been normal for me to say, what can we use indicators to represent something or to summarize this complex information in ways that are useful and meaningful for action, for decision making in some way. And so I was involved with Bedrick Moldan and others in designing the Commission of Development's program on indicators and helping to implement it at the United Nations. I was asked by the World Economic Forum to revise the Environmental Sustainability Index, to design the Environmental Performance Index. We did a very interesting index with a group in Fiji called the South Pacific Geoscience Commission, because I talked about the need for indices of island vulnerability. And it was done for the economics, but not for the environment. So we put together a project to develop a vulnerability index that could be used for all countries. And we got 50 different indicators for all the different dimensions of vulnerability, for such things as climate change, natural disasters, biodiversity, water diversification. How might countries be vulnerable? And then a whole country profile. Where are you resilient? Where are you vulnerable? Where should the priorities be going? And then comparing this across countries, you can really see where you should be putting the emphasis. I had to explain this to the Minister of Development from Ireland in 3 minutes. He was about to speak in Mauritius. He said, what's this I'm supposed to be saying something about? So I explained, I pulled out the Irish profile. These are your problems. He said, that's fantastic. He gave this wonderful endorsement of the project. So if even a politician can understand in 3 minutes, it must do something. And that's the power of indicators. If they're designed properly, you may be able to have an effect. So then, what is the way forward? What can a systems view help us to say about the way forward? Civilizations, as we've already heard, have come and gone. So we can't be so certain that ours is going to last forever. And we have choices for society. We can go business as usual. And that's what the limits to growth studies have said is going to lead us to some kind of catastrophe. And all the signs are that that seems to be what's happening. There's nothing said that's not going to happen. There are those who say we should retreat to a fortress world, lock ourselves behind the frontiers, keep the immigrants out, you know, and somehow do things for ourselves, forget about the rest of the world. But is that a solution? Do you want to give up bananas or pineapples? You know. So, really, and we know scientifically, a transition to sustainability is technically possible. We know how to do it. We know most of the solutions are there. It's not a scientific or technological problem. As we've said already, it's a human problem. And I've always felt that we really need to add to the three dimensions of sustainability a fourth dimension. Some people are already doing it one way or the other, which would bring together the cultural, institutional, organizational dimension. How do we organize ourselves to respond to these problems? And the ethical, spiritual aspects. Why do we need to respond? How do we choose among the choices we have to make between social, economic, and environmental? And I think until we bring that dimension in and say, this is an important place in our decision-making about sustainability, we're going to keep missing the essential part of the challenges that we're facing ahead. And this is in many ways, why I say, the information dimension. How is information being coded, being used, being evaluated and judged in order to decide how we balance the different parts of sustainability? And that then leads me to the conclusion that human systems must have what we might call a spiritual dimension. You know, if we look at human life as a complex multi-level system for each individual, we're clearly a biological organism. We have to eat and so on and so forth like any other kind of organism. We're also a social entity that develops very complex communities. So that's a whole another level of organization beyond the biological. But I think we also have potential for what you might call emergent properties of what many cultures call spiritual or ethical or values or ideals. There's another dimension to humanity that goes beyond even the social in what we're able to generate and what we're able to create, and that is valued in many cultures and many religions around the world. And it all relates to that fundamental human struggle between the self or the ego, the selfishness, all the me first of the child versus the mature altruistic adult. It's what has sometimes been called the growth of that intangible dimension of each individual, which is sometimes called the soul or many other things, towards some kind of an absolute, which has many terms, God or whatever else you want to call it in your own cultural tradition. And I think that new science lacks the tools to address this level, even though it's almost universal in human experience. But it's probably unreasonable or even arrogant on the parts of scientists to deny its importance and to limit ourselves to only what science can measure. And why not just admit that there are things that are beyond science and that still have a place, have an important influence on the way in which we function? So you might say religion defined as a knowledge system or domain of human experience rather than any of the specific institutions like in churches or things like that, has a place in considerations of sustainability. And of course we've already seen sustainability is at the interface of science and ethics. So we have to redefine development, which unfortunately for economists always means growth. They equate the two, but it's much more than that perhaps. In a more universal framework, including society, culture, science, and spirituality. And so, what is our purpose as individuals and as a society? What is our vision of the future? Science alone can't answer those questions. So, on what other basis do we try to answer them? And I think ethics and values are, since they determine how we relate to each other, they're part of the answer to the questions we have to ask there. And I think we need, therefore, to say, how do we create an ethical system for sustainability? We've already heard in some presentations today that behavior change is fundamental to making a transition. You know, we talk about it a lot, we've got all these ideas out there, but how do we change the way we act? How do we change our fundamental habits? Those are some of the hardest things for us to change. And it requires motivation, emotional commitment, often self-sacrifice, a spirit of service. These are things that are not part of the typical realm of science, and yet we can see logically they must be considered as you try to go ahead. I even think we've talked a lot about the selfish gene, perpetuating itself. Maybe there are selfish values which perpetuate themselves in the collective evolution of communities. Those communities that have values of, you know, ethical values are, have a better chance of surviving because of those values and perpetuate themselves in moving us more towards altruism and cooperation and away from those things that are driving us more towards self-destruction. So this ethical system really be looking at this next step in our human evolution towards the oneness of humankind, and therefore saying that will allow us to build higher levels of organization, of complexity, of efficiency. The potential this can open up, if we can start with ethical framework, will allow a whole new flourishing of civilization at the planetary level once we get over the problems that we're facing today. So I'm still an optimist after 40 years from that perspective. But then you might say, well, how do we program people with the right kinds of values to move towards a more desirable society? This is really an educational challenge in a sense. But some of the values you'd probably want to include in that, we've heard about them because they're also related to the indicators we were talking about: unity and diversity, solidarity, the elimination of poverty, which is totally unsustainable to maintain so much poverty in the world, justice, trustworthiness, moderation, social responsibility, a more cooperative and altruistic economic system that can create employment for all, that can draw out that wealth creation potential in every human being, and sustainable environmental management. Religion, of course, has been the ethical domain of human experience, and therefore we must say, how do we involve this dimension in the work that we do in sustainability? My own perspective, of course, I was raised in the Baha'i faith, so the values that I inherited that gave me my framework, my systems perspective, was already one of an evolutionary concept of religion as one common faith, the harmony of science and religion, oneness of humanity, independent investigation, using reason for everything, including religion, sustainable environmental management, moderation, material civilization, the need for a federated world government, the structures to govern society at the global level. You know, this is part of my personal life system, and I can't deny its existence. It's always been there, and therefore it had to be part of this talk, even if it upsets some scientists to talk about such things in such a context. But for me, science and religion are two great knowledge systems that should be complementary. Science is values neutral. Religion focuses on values. Both of them are talking about one underlying truth of the human being and human society. Both of them require reason, and they must be in balance. If you have lots of science and no religion, you fall into materialism. You've got lots of religion and no science, you fall into superstition. We've seen both ends of the spectrum in our world today, unfortunately. But there is some hope. In November of last year, at Windsor Castle, the major religions all launched action plans on climate change, with Ban Ki-moon from the Secretary of the United Nations and Prince Philip welcoming all the religions and accepting their action plans. So when the UN wasn't certain if they could succeed in Copenhagen, said, well, at least we got the religions together. We did something in 2009. Because UNDP was the one that, with ARC, one of the partners of this project, that sponsored this activity. And therefore, this, you can now sort of understand the logic behind doing a project in values-based indicators. Because we've started by asking if we can measure these things that are so important. Because, you know, if you can't see it, how can you do anything about it? Unemployment was not an issue until the development of the statistics. Suddenly it was on the radar screen, probably we had to do something about it, because there was a number for it. So even though you might say, can you really measure values? And probably you can't in some way. If you can't put some kind of indicators on them, how do you make them visible enough to start saying, those are important, we should be doing something about them? This is as much about communication as it is about touching some essential and fundamental truth. And we try to design a system that leaves room for the mystical, that leaves room for the spiritual, that doesn't exclude the intangible dimension, but also makes enough of it visible in terms of how the values are implemented in our lives to actually, we can provide indicators that give us some sense that this is happening, this is important, this is driving us forward, we need to be doing more of it. And hopefully these have been tools to direct our own evolution towards a more advancing civilization. So you know about the project. I may have a few of you come this evening, worked here for the conference already. I just put in a couple of slides to mention that we have set up a website for the project to tell you something about the indicators that have been developed in this project and the whole process of starting either from indicators themselves or values, in order to see your way forward, to see how this is an important part of your activities. So in conclusion, I wanted to look briefly then, what might you say after, 45 years or so dealing with sustainability, what might be some conclusions about a systems approach to the many dimensions of life and society? And I think clearly, if you might say, the elements of sustainable systems paradigm, that these such systems are in balance, they respect some principles of moderation or optimal size. It's not growth forever and ever and ever. There's the point at which you reach the ideal size, and you should stop there, whether you're a business or an economy or a country. You recognize that that's the organic way of doing things. Nothing lives forever, except a few microbes, perhaps. They mostly, they sort of die and are reborn at something else. Maybe all bureaucracies should do the same thing. Should have a 40-year date limit on bureaucracies. 40 years, they've expired, they meet their sell-by limit. We should junk it and start over again. Tax systems the same way. The only way we've been able to reform bureaucracy has been war and revolution. Maybe we should find a more civilized way of doing it. And thinking about optimal sizes and date limits may be a way of building a little more renewal into our own mechanism of society. Subsidiarity, taking things down to the lowest responsible level, efficiency, dematerialization. We can do a lot more with less and less, and the technology allows us to do that, so that needs to be one of the key elements of some people are calling the green economy. Integrating closed cycles, not just using things once and throwing them away, like all the cell phones that we saw earlier and so on. There's an enormous amount of waste. Everything's got to be closed, like in the coral reef. Everything is closed except energy on the coral reef. Managing information more effectively, developing the indicators for the different elements of sustainability, and using natural systems inspiration. If nature can do it, then we can probably try to do it as well. It's not some utopia that's totally beyond any kind of reality, because natural systems already do it. We have models that show these kinds of systems can succeed, but they don't have people in them. Maybe that's the problem. I actually saw a study some years ago where an economist said, we can have the perfect economy, very high GDP, really fantastic, just have to get rid of people. They're the problem. They go on strike and so on. But computers can make, robots can make computers, and we've got the perfect system for economists. But is that really the purpose of all of this? And then we need to define and implement responses to put us on necessary trajectories towards sustainability and create a foundation, ethical principles to motivate necessary changes in human behavior. And of course, this really means human transformation. We've got to build the framework for each individual person so they can choose their own directions towards prosperity, sustainability, and ever-advancing world civilization based on the oneness of humanity. We need, as I mentioned, to bring science and religion together to find that balance, to find not only the what and how, but why we should be doing some of these things. We should be educating everybody in science and values, investing in human capital as the best way to develop human potential. That was the example in Taiwan. They went from 20 universities to 150 universities in 20 or 30 years. And that's I think, one of the major lessons. That's really where the wealth comes from if we invest in it. So I don't think the UK government's going quite that way at the moment, from what I've heard. But education is also the only way to ensure sustainability across generations. None of us is sustainable as an individual. We're all going to die sooner or later. And so the only way that we have to pass on our knowledge, our wisdom, our culture, our traditions, and so on. Education is the fundamental dimension of human sustainability. It never stops. And all of you involved in academia are many at the core of that process. And there's no need for central planning. If you get the rules right, the system will develop itself. There's no central plan on a coral reef. But because each of the organisms is programmed with the necessary elements contributing to collaborate in the overall system, it all works, it evolves, it develops, it adapts to itself. And that can again be a model, not that we can conceive of one single utopia, but how do we get the ground rules right at an ethical level so that each community can find its own path towards sustainability in its own particular local context. Now, a couple of suggestions for those who are academics here. You have probably gathered that I'm not a typical academic from my career path. But I think you could probably say there are other coherences than disciplinary coherence. And you need sometimes to have the courage to step beyond your disciplinary boundaries. And even perhaps sometimes reach beyond science while asking scientific questions. We should be using the scientific method with an open mind as to its limitations. It's not going to solve everything for us. And have the honesty to recognize that we can't know everything. rather than limiting ourselves to what we can know, which is what many sciences do today. Well, I'm sure I can know it, but that's all that must exist. And in fact, real solutions to all these problems lie beyond any one discipline. They require progress at multiple levels in many dimensions of society, from values to governance. So perhaps we need a new academic field. Maybe University of Brighton will become the pioneer in this area, in research and training in broad systems integration, the ability to develop scenarios for the future, strategic planning, bringing in human values and motivation, the generalists able to look at the highest levels of organization and systems behavior and management to be one guide towards sustainability. I say one because it's not going to have to be a top-down thing by itself. We need something at that level. But we also need a new approach to education that can empower everybody with the ability to see both the large picture and the specific actions they need at the community level within an ethical framework. We need then multiple approaches to sustainability that will evolve naturally and organically as civilization advances. And a systems perspective can perhaps inspire the new generation, and there's some of you here in this room, to see present environmental problems not as a disaster, but as an opportunity to build a new future. Thank you very much, and thanks to the university for giving me the honor of this title of visiting professor.
Being the one to thank Arthur for that talk, and I'm very happy indeed to do that. Thank you very much, Arthur. For those of you that have just arrived tonight, my name is Mary Harder, and I'm a professor here at the University of Brighton in Sustainable Waste Management. And you know, you never know what you can get, what you're going to get in an inaugural lecture for a professorship, because some people tell their life stories, some people tell you the latest problem they're working on. The only requirement is that we're actually asked to do is to somehow convey to the audience evidence for why you were awarded the title. And should we say he passed? I especially liked the bit about the corals, which had the reflective extras to make sure that any sunlight that didn't, you know, came nearby but not exactly on them was funneled back to them. And I wondered if you had any new method of doing this for funding. that would be really useful. Yeah, that really would.
We'll talk to Brussels.
Well, you know, I've never had the situation before where I've had to thank somebody and they've stealed my thunder, because I actually wanted to talk about how I heard you say once at a university, to somebody in the university, that universities traditionally produce specialists. That's what universities traditionally do. And of course, we're into the era now where everybody knows specialists aren't enough. They need to be able to start to look across other disciplines, and we could call them generalized specialists. And what you then said, generalized specialists, but still specialists with some little connections. And then what you said, but actually what we really need is specialized generalists, where the focus is on the generalizing, and the specialism is a secondary thing. Of course, you have to be quite old and mature to be able to do something like that. And I think that with all these specialisms you've shown in your talk and your ability to link across them, that you've shown you really are a very good example of a specialized generalist. So congratulations, you've met your own standards. Well, it's been absolutely wonderful working with you in the last couple of years on this values-based indicators project. It was a rocky ride. We had no idea where we were going, but it's worked out very well. And I look forward to many more years of working with you, and I'd like you to consider this a very warm welcome, your official warm welcome as a visiting professor to the University of Brighton. Thank you very much indeed. University of Brighton of not having questions for the poor chap who's just laid out his life for you in the last hour, but you can talk to him and ask questions over the wonderful reception that the team has set out for you next door. There'll be time to ask questions there. I'd like to just remind any of you that don't know that there is actually a conference going on, and if any of you want to join us tomorrow or the next day, it is free and it's open to all, and you are very welcome. Please go next door and enjoy some drinks and some reception food. Thank you very much. That's all for tonight.